title is The Effects of Serial Casting Duration on Ankle Range of Motion and Mobility in Ambulatory Children with Spastic Cerebral Palsy, and our presenters are Allison, Jessica, Scott, and Claire.
Thank you, Dr. Dean. Our supervisor is Kathy Davidson. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here as she's been our supervisor from the interior, but a few long distance calls and she's pretty good with things how they are. So, cerebral palsy. This is a non-progressive disorder caused by the brain lesions. These occur either prenatally, perinatally, or postnatally within 2 years of birth. It's the most common cause of neuromuscular disability in children and can be classified as either spastic, ataxic, or dyskinetic. The most common of which is the spastic cerebral palsy, which occurs in 77% of children with cerebral palsy. It's characterized by hypertonia, development of contractures, immobility around the joints affected, and development of a quinescate if it affects the lower limb. Typically, cerebral palsy is classified based on the gross motor functional classification system. This is a system that uses both the child's level of ambulation as well as whether they use ambulation aids to measure or to get around. In our study itself, we use levels 1 to 3, where the weakest child would be the one using handheld mobility device, whereas others would be walking without limitations. When it comes to spastic cerebral palsy, there's four treatment options, either invasive or non-invasive. For invasive treatment options, we have surgery, which would be tendon lengthening, and botulinum toxin A injections, which is usually done in conjunction with other treatments. For non-invasive, we have your manual short duration stretching, which is your typical passive range of motion stretching you'd see in your regular gym, and prolonged stretching methods, which would include serial casting, AFOs, or splinting. With regards to the surgical intervention, the surgical tendon release is common to use to release spastic muscles or release the contractures therein. It's best performed before 6 years of age due to reoccurrence. And these reoccurrence of contractures can actually happen up to 50% if the surgery is done under the age of 3. This would lead to further surgeries and further risk for the child, such as over-lengthening of the tendon, infection, scarring, or side effects of anesthesia. When it comes to botulinum toxin A injections, these are both fast and have few side effects. However, the several benefits including increased range of motion, decreased spasticity, and improved function. However, this is not always available outside of urban areas, and it can be expensive for parents and families, even for the medical providers as well. It also has a problem of being time-consuming as a specialist appointment is required for the injection. With regard to the manual short-duration stretching, typically, as I said, this is the stretching we'd use in the non-pathological population held for greater than 20 seconds. In one study, it was actually a systematic review, they found that with spastic or non-neurological population, that there's no long-lasting benefits with regards to range of motion, mobility, contracture risk, or decreased spasticity. However, it was found that there is still place for this in therapy with these children to decrease muscle cramping, increase joint lubrication, change positions, and also fit devices such as AFOs or night splints. With regards to serial casting, a landmark study in 1988 by Tardieu found that a greater than 6 hours stretching per day would help prevent contracture development. Casting is a great way to achieve this stretch. However, no specific guidelines for serial casting has been found for spastic cerebral palsy. In general, in one Cincinnati hospital, they found that for lower extremity casting, they should use a clinically recommended 1 to 4 progressions of 7 to 10 days. And this can be supplemented with physiotherapy treatments, a heel cord lengthening procedure, balance training, or the use of night splints and AFOs. So now looking more at a research question, what's the most effective prolonged stretch intervention duration to treat children with spastic cerebral palsy? We break it into 3 aims, 1 primary and 2 secondary. The primary aim looking at the serial casting's effect on dorsiflexion range of motion, And then the secondary, looking at its effect on spasticity, gait, and functional ability, as well as looking at whether different intensities or durations can affect the sustainability or the effect of the casting. We took these into a PICO search for our systematic review, where for a population, we were looking at ambulatory children with spastic cerebral palsy. Our intervention was serial casting with or without a follow-up treatment, which could entail AFO usage. And then our comparison is not a typical comparison. However, we're looking at the effects of different types of serial casting protocols and how they affect our outcomes. And of course, our outcomes being dorsiflexion, passive range of motion, spasticity, gait characteristics, and function. We took our PICO to develop our search strategy, breaking it into four streams under three categories. The first category being the children with spastic cerebral palsy. Second, focusing around the ankle joint, as it is our target joint. And then the third, of course, looking at serial casting interventions. These were all combined using an Angulian function. Our searches, we put through seven different databases, including Medline, Embase, CINAHL, SportDiscuss, PsycInfo, Cochrane, DARE, and then also gray literature researches by going through reference lists. In total, we had 357 studies found through our searches, 11 of which were included in the systematic review. Just for a bit of a closer look at how we went through the search strategy of each database, for instance, with Embase, originally we came with 196 results, 99 of which were removed due to being non-human, non-English, and not of the appropriate age for our study. Duplicate results were removed when compared to other databases. And then the remaining 26 results from Embase, we would put through a review of their title, their abstract, and the inclusion and exclusion criteria using a criteria data sheet that we developed. Of course, with Embase, we were left with two results, and now Claire will go through the rest of the inclusion and exclusion criteria. Thank you.
So when we reviewed the studies, we looked at our inclusion and exclusion criteria. So just to quickly define that, our inclusion criteria, we looked at all study types that were specific to our study. So they could have been RCTs, individual cohorts, case series, or before and after studies. We used no limitation in terms of publication dates. Our study looked at children from 0 to 18 years of age and levels 1 to 3 on the GMSCS. We were looking at limited dorsiflexion range of motion so that we could look at the study parameter of range of motion. Studies examining the effect of serial casting on ankle range of motion, walking abilities, and or functional abilities. In terms of concurrent treatments, we included studies that had concurrent treatments provided that they weren't the focus of the study. So, for example, if we had a study that was looking at Botox versus serial casting, then we could include the serial casting only information. However, if we were looking at a study that was looking at Botox and serial casting, we would not be able to include the information. For the exclusion criteria, again, studies that were not investigating the ankle joint were excluded. Non-English studies in non-human population. As I stated already, research concurrent studies were allowed, but if they focused on recent surgeries or they had Botox, then it wasn't allowed. In terms of our level of evidence, we used the AACPDM level of evidence scale, and anything that was scoring a level 5, we did not allow. And we used the Downs and Blacks quality assessment scale, so anything that scored less than a 16, we excluded. The Downs and Black checklist is a questionnaire that has 27 points on it, looking at 5 basic criteria: reporting, external validity, internal validity, confounding, and power. And the reason we chose to use this guide, I mean, it's longer than the Pedro, but the one thing that makes it great for our studies is that it can be used for RCTs and non-RCTs, and it's got really great inter-rater reliability, so it's excellent for our cerebral palsy population. In terms of our levels of evidence, we use the American College of Cerebral Palsy and Developmental Medicine levels of evidence, and it was based on the Oxford scales. However, it was adapted for cerebral palsy and developmental disability research, so again, specific to our population, which is a highly heterogeneous population with a low incidence, and it can be used for a single study design. So as you can see in our chart there, the level fives, which were excluded, and everything else that was included on above it. In terms of our data extraction, we looked at four specific criteria, some study characteristics, title, author, year, etc., traits of the participants, serial casting parameters, so how long they were stretched, number of casts that were used, the study outcomes, primary outcome being our dorsiflexion, and then any of the other ones like spasticity and gait that were included, we also documented to see if there were anything we can compare. So we had this standardized form with all this information, and two reviewers independently extracted the information, and then we compared it, and if there were any disagreements, we had a third-party arbitrator to settle the disagreements. So this is a quick example of our data extraction sheet that included the four parameters that I just stated, and then we just filled it out as we went, and then compared it at the end. So the study characteristics that we generally found, we had 11 papers total in our systematic review for the inclusion and exclusion criteria. Our study designs had randomized controlled trials, outcome research, which was before and after studies, as well as retrospective research, which is typically looked at through extracting from files. The AACPDM levels of evidence were 1, 2, and 4, and the blacks and downs scores ranged between 21 and 28. The papers that we extracted were published between 1986 and 2006. In terms of participants, there were 7 to 28 participants in the studies that we had, and the mean age was 2.58 years to 9.4 years, so mostly between 4 years and 7. The casting procedure that was used was lightweight fiberglass lengths, below knee short leg walking casts. The intensity of stretch was highly variable between the studies. So some did casting at 0 to 5 degrees, some cast with a goal of 10 degrees dorsiflexion, others with a goal of 20 degrees dorsiflexion, or they casted between R1 and R2. So highly variable. The duration of casting was between 2.8 weeks and 6 weeks. And the casts were changed every 1 to 3 weeks. We noted that the 6 of the studies also used stretching devices post-casting, which included AFOs, night splints, bivalve fiberglass splints. So when we look at the range of motion data that we extracted, people reported their post-casting information, which is on the left, and their follow-up information, which is on the right side. Again, high variability. Some people reported their mean change in range of motion. Some people just reported their follow-up data. And if you note, in the pink is the studies that where a significant range of motion was highlighted, and in blue as not significant. So again, in this study, not as much reported in the immediately post-casting group. But in the follow-up group, there was a lot more reporting and more significance noted. So again, lots of variability, making it quite difficult to compare the studies. What we can say is that all 11 studies showed a short-term increase in dorsiflexion range of motion. Some of them were significant, some of them didn't state significance. The general trend was that it ranged between a mean change in dorsiflexion range of motion of about 7.55 degrees to 16 degrees, and most numbers fell between that 10 to 13 degree range. Interestingly, the group that casted at max dorsiflexion, they observed a change between 15 and 17 degrees. However, there were no follow-ups done with this, and so again, difficult to look at that in terms of maintenance long term. The most common protocol that was used was a 3 to 4 week casting period, and casts were changed every 1 to 2 weeks. When we looked at, generally speaking, as I mentioned already, that the there was so much variability in the methodology that it makes it difficult to compare. But what we can say in terms of range of motion was that 8 of them looked at follow-up assessments, and 5 of the 8 of the studies were significant in terms of maintaining range of motion at the follow-up dates. The time period where they looked at follow-up was variable. Some of them was 12 weeks, some of them was up to 6 months. And so those that did, they noted that there was significance maintained between those 12 to 6 weeks. And another interesting note is that 6 of the studies used AFOs and night sweats post-casting. And 4 of those studies noted that there was range of motion gains maintained at that follow-up marker. So it indicates to us that there may be some influence in maintaining range of motion, the use of AFOs and night sweats, and so it's something that should be followed up long term. However, it's unclear if there's any specific protocol that we can say that is superior from this information. So I will let Allison follow up with some of the further information that we have.
Okay. So the studies that we looked at included a lot of secondary outcome measures as well. One of these was spasticity. Most of the studies referred to this outcome as spasticity and measured it by resistance to high velocity stretch, versions of the Ashworth scales, or the TARG scale. One study referred to it as tone and used Ashworth scores for this measurement. Ashworth scales are typically used to measure spasticity, therefore the results of this study were included in our review. 5 of the 6 studies showed a significant reduction in spasticity post-casting. 2 studies by Brower found improvements after 3 to 4 weeks of casting, which lasted up to 6 weeks. And 3 studies by Ackman, Flett, and Kay found significant improvements after 3 to 6 weeks of casting, which lasted for much longer periods, about to 12 months. It is of note that these 3 studies, the subjects did wear AFOs, night splints, or have other physiotherapy treatment post-casting. In one study by Corey, there were no significant improvements in spasticity found, even at 2 weeks post-casting. So comparing these studies, there were no major differences in casting parameters. All subjects were cast for between 3 to 6 weeks of total casting, between 0 to 10 degrees of dorsiflexion, and were a similar level on the GMFCS scale. So why didn't the study by Corey find improvements in spasticity? Perhaps it was due to the difference in ages of the participants. The 5 studies with significance had subjects ranging in age from 3 years, 6 months to 9 years and 4 months, while Corey's group had a mean subject age of 4 years and 7 months. So perhaps casting is slightly more effective on an older age group. However, the overlap in mean subject ages and the limited number of studies and limited number of subjects makes it difficult to actually draw this conclusion. Does the use of night splints or AFOs post-casting assist in the maintenance of improvements in spasticity? The 3 studies, which showed long-lasting improvements in spasticity, did use stretching devices post-casting. This is consistent with what Tardieu found in 1988. The 2 significant studies, which did not use stretching devices post-casting, didn't do follow-up measures beyond 6 weeks, so we can't be sure if the improvements in spasticity would have been maintained without splint use. Another secondary outcome measure were temporospatial measures of gait, which included stride length, gait velocity, and percentage of time spent in single limb support. 3 studies used video gait analysis to measure changes in these parameters. In 2 of the studies, the subjects wore AFOs post-casting, the other did not mention it. None of the studies found significant improvements in either stride length or velocity at any assessment time. Although the study by McNeely found an improvement in the percentage of time spent in single limb support immediately post-casting, this change was no longer significant at 12 weeks. Yet another secondary outcome measure was ankle kinematics. It is of interest to know whether the improvements gained in passive range of motion at the ankle remained during active movement. There were 4 studies that showed improvements in ankle kinematics. These measures of kinematics include dorsiflexion at initial foot contact, peak dorsiflexion in stance and in swing, and overall maximum dorsiflexion during gait. 2 studies found significant improvements that remained at 12 weeks, while 2 studies found these improvements were no longer maintained. So do the improvements from serial casting translate into improved dynamic range of motion? It appears that yes, there is a general trend towards improved dynamic range of motion after casting. It also appears that AFO use post-casting can help to maintain these improvements. However, more research needs to be done. Two studies that did use AFOs had long-lasting improvements. However, one study in which some subjects did use AFOs, the improvements were not maintained. Another secondary outcome measure is qualitative measures of gait. The studies that we looked at included various outcome measures for quality and various rating systems, which made it difficult to draw conclusions when comparing the studies. But there were five studies that found improvements in gait quality. A study by Brower found significant reductions in toe walking post-casting. However, it was not stated if these improvements were maintained at 6 weeks. It was noted that two subjects did return to Aquinas gait. In the study by Cotalorda, it was found that there were significant improvements in heel toe gait that were maintained in 2/3 of subjects at 18 months. A study by Watt found significant improvements in foot contact and stance, even at 5 months post-casting. More subjects had lasting improvements in their right foot than in their left, but the authors were not able to explain this difference, though. Two studies used the physician's rating scale for video gait analysis. This scale gives a general rating of gait quality according to crouch, knee position, and foot contact. Corey found an overall significant change in PRS for gait, which remained at 12 weeks, although it was noted that there was some decrease in this improvement according just as foot contact. Flett also found significant improvements according to the PRS scale at 2, 4, and 6 months post-casting. It is of note that the three studies where gait quality was significantly improved over a longer period of time, all subjects wore AFOs or night splints post-casting treatment. So overall, there is conflicting evidence for the effectiveness of serial casting on gait quality, because it's difficult to compare these studies. It appears that serial casting can be effective to improve quality of gait, and we can infer that AFO and night splint use post-casting can help to maintain these gains. We have one more secondary outcome measure to look at, which is function, and Jess is going to talk about that.
This is our last secondary outcome, and then we'll sum it all up for you to bring it all together. So the last one we did choose to look at was function, and as you can see, five different papers looked at this topic, and you can see that a variety of outcome measures are used again, so it was difficult to really compare them. So some people use parental report, clinician report, as well as the GMFM, which is the gross motor functional metric. You can also see that the pink ones are the significant ones. Green was not significant, and the ones I highlighted in yellow are just ones that reported what they found but didn't really state whether there are any implications of that. So overall, 4 out of 5 studies showed some kind of functional improvement post-casting, whether that be in parental reports, clinician reports, or the GMFM. The GMFM in particular did show some longer-lasting effects in studies by Flett and Kay. However, the times that they lasted for was slightly different. So in Flett, they found significance at 1, 3, and 5 months, whilst K was at 6, 9, and 12 months, but not at 3 months. The two studies that did not show anything significant was a study by Watt and all, which used the developmental motor skills tool, and Flett and all didn't really show any improvements in terms of parental report. The one that we found the most interesting to really look at was the GMFM, so we could really compare that between the studies, a little bit more standardized. And we did find it interesting that the two studies that did look at that found slightly different results in terms of follow-up. In both of these studies, the casting was done in neutral dorsiflexion, and they also used the stretching devices post-casting, so AFOs or night splints. So we kind of pondered why this could be different, and there were slight differences in ages again, and there were slight differences in terms of casting procedures for how long they were casted for. However, a lot of the studies pointed out that because the follow-ups were so long, especially the one at 12 months, the improvements could actually be due to developmental progress instead of the casting specifically. It's hard to tell at this point which it may be. So in general for function, most of these found some form of improvement despite differences in casting parameters used. No major differences in intervention between the studies that reported improvements and those that did not were found. And again, it was difficult to compare the studies because so many different outcome measures were used. So we'll bring it all together for now. This SR indicates several different things, and I've lost my spot on my page. So results from this SR indicate that serial casting can be an effective non-invasive treatment option for improving dorsiflexion range of motion and reducing spasticity in children with spastic cerebral palsy. In terms of these improvements for range of motion and spasticity, there may have some carryover effect on gait quality and functional mobility. However, there's conflicting evidence on the impact on ankle kinematics, and there was no effect evident on stride length and velocity. Furthermore, no specific casting parameters have been identified by doing this SR. In the majority of the studies, they casted for anywhere between 3 and 6 weeks, and they were all found to be somewhat effective. The casts were changed weekly or bi-weekly, and there was no indication of the best intensity stretch. And so by intensity stretch, I mean if they were casted at the max or more, like a 0 to 10 degree dorsiflexion. The use of AFOs and or night splints post-casting may assist in the maintenance of improvements in range of motion, spasticity, and gait quality. And this is, again, consistent with the study by Targan et al. In 1988, which stated you needed 6 hours of stretching to maintain range of motion and prevent contractures. So again, there's lots of limitations that are involved here. You have basically two streams of limitations. The first one has to do with our SR and the methodology, so the meta-analysis is difficult. And the second main one, which I'll talk about on the next slide, just looks at basically doing research on clinical populations and the problems that may present. So for this study, the differences in methodology include differences in casting parameters, post-casting treatment, so the use of AFOs or not using AFOs or some kind of mixture within the study, and differences in follow-up times, which made it very difficult to compare. There was also differences in outcome measures which made it difficult to compare, and as I mentioned in function, there are lots of different ones used. And there was differences in how the data was reported. Clara made a lot of mention to that, and that for range of motion. A lot of studies chose to present it in terms of change in range of motion or pre and post range of motion, and other studies showed p-values, but a lot of times they would report both, so it made it pretty difficult. And in terms of studying the clinical population, the main problems are that there's a lot of variability between participants, and for CP, there's a lot of variety between someone who's a level 1 and level 3, as well as within a single level. Small sample sizes, and there's basically lower levels of evidence, and that can be because of this variability or the small sample sizes, but it's also because, you know, well-controlled rigor study is difficult to execute when you can't really create much of a control group. And then just to sum it all together again, the clinical implications of this study. In general, we found that this SR found that all the results were consistent with the general guidelines proposed by the Cincinnati Children's Hospital, which Scott mentioned at the beginning. So the hospital recommends 1-4 progressions of 7 to 10 days, and we basically found that as well. So 3 to 6 weeks in total was used with weekly to bi-weekly progressions. The recommendations also state that follow-up casting should be followed up with PT, stretching, strengthening, and night splints. And although our studies didn't really look too much at stretching, strengthening, or physio post-casting, they did look at a lot of night splints, and we seem to find very consistent results that will help maintain. A few new things to consider. Since we found that a wide variety of total treatment times can be effective, it basically just drives home the point that if you are choosing to cast someone, you should really use your clinical reasoning to determine the best number of progressions for each client, your total number of weeks you want to keep them in a cast. So you want to try to maximize the benefits, but also minimize any detrimental effects of prolonged immobilization. So you really just have to kind of keep in mind that there may be a lot of difference between subjects. So more is not always better. Longer may not be better. In terms of the intensity of stretch, again, the studies looked at a lot of different intensities, and although Clara mentioned that the casting and maximal dorsiflexion may result in more gains at 0 weeks, there was no follow-up in those studies, so we don't know if that would actually be maintained. Clinically, it's important to consider the client's comfort when you're choosing which intensity you want to stretch them at. It may not be very comfortable to be in max dorsiflexion for 2, 3, 4 weeks. Basically, the study shows that casting at a less intense stretch, so 0 to 10 degrees or other parameters, may still be effective. So that's just good to know that more is not necessarily better. And our final clinical implication is that although we found that casting seems to be effective, as with anything, don't abandon all your other adjunct treatments that you'd normally do with this population. So continue with stretching, strengthening, balance training, anything that you deem appropriate. And although the recent SR that Scott mentioned basically said that short-duration stretching is not effective in a neurological population, there still is a place in treatment for that. So again, that might be for joint lubrication and positions changing and prevention of muscle cramping, especially for non-ambulatory children. So that's basically it. We'd like to thank our supervisor, Kathy Davidson. She's in Penticton, and she did a great job at meeting up with us via teleconference and booking the room in the conference room on the second floor, so that was great. Thank you to Charlotte, who helped us with the script at the beginning, especially last year, as well as helping us dig up some articles that we couldn't find online. And also the people at Sunny Hill, we met with them one day, and they gave us some kind of clinical advice, which was very helpful. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You guys mentioned at the beginning when you were talking about alternative treatments that Botox can be problematic because, you know, there's appointments and you have to go see a specialist and things like that. I was wondering in the studies that you reviewed if they talked at all about the feasibility of implementing serial casting and, like, who are the main players in this?
Main players with Botox or serial casting?
No, with serial casting, like how much time is involved, are there specialist appointments, those kind of things?
Well, the serial casting, we talked to the supervisor a lot about that, and it sounds like you can be trained to do it, so it does offer more outlets for people that can provide it, whereas with Botox, you're going to be waiting for specific doctors to do it, so the wait times can be longer. At Sunny Hill, it sounded like a lot of times they do stuff in conjunction, so they'll Botox and then cast. However, we are in Vancouver, so it may be more difficult in other areas. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, definitely.
So, you talked about that one study that mentioned tone, but then they used the Ashworth scale.
Yes.
So is that pretty representative of what's out there? Is there a need for standardization? Or?
So, yeah, we had lots of trouble with that. We actually kind of separated the data initially, and then we realized they were all using the same measures. A lot of times in the studies, they would say tone in one spot and then flip to spasticity somewhere else. And it seems like there's just a lot of controversy almost surrounding the issue. So we kind of looked at some research, and they said that in research, the Target and Ashworth and all that was good for measuring spasticity, and that seems to be what's used. So we decided to clump it together so we could actually draw a few more conclusions.
And we did ask our supervisor about that as well, and she said that there seems to be a lot of interchangeable use of those terms. So a lot of people call it tone, a lot of people call it spasticity, but they're talking about the same thing. And so it kind of makes it, you know, we were trying to tease them apart because they are different according to what we learned in the program. But the studies kind of put them together. So we worked with what we had.
So when they looked at spasticity, when they rechecked spasticity, R1, R2, or was it like actually, because from what I understand, spasticity can't be changed by serial casting.
Usually we're looking at it more from a tone perspective, so actually whether it could move in general, like on a passive range of motion. I mean, for instance, with the TARDU, the 1988 landmark study, it was very much the slow movement and measuring at those points.
However, the Brower studies did look at resistance to high velocity stretch, which you'd think would trigger a little bit more of a spasm. But again, there was just a lot of. Yeah, and it was improved.
So, yeah, in those studies, anyway. They did look at resistance to high velocity stretch. It was improved after passing.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas as to why? What's the mechanism then? Why do you think it would?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, since it would be more neurologically based, it's a little bit fishy per se, but all I can think is if you have some lengthening going on, it's just, it's not reaching a stretch quite as quickly, and because the velocity that it's going through is ridiculously fast, if they were talking 400 meters per second, or degrees per second or something, like it's a really fast rotation, maybe it just takes a little bit longer to kick in. They didn't really get into it too much in it, so it's hard to say.
Has much been done in the adult population? When I think of serial casting, I often think of it with this precise population.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much has been done in the adult, because we were specifically looking at children. Mm-hmm. But we did find a lot of studies that involved adults.
Well, London did for 0 to 18. It did knock out a rather large amount of studies, so we assume there is a lot of, but due to the amount of information we had to sort through with the children, we didn't focus onto that all too long.
I think it works on a balance of, like, a focus of our study was the cerebral palsy population, and so in terms of the adult population, you're looking at strokes and whatnot in terms of serial castings, whether it be for spasticity or range of motion gains. That, falling back on our study, one of the interesting parameters that when we were talking with Sunny Hill Hospital is that they don't want to do any of the tendon lengthening surgeries before the age of 7 because of the complications that we discussed in terms of how the muscular tendon unit reacts, and also in terms of the possibility of recurrence. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, what came out through that discussion at Sunny Hill Hospital was that Botox requires higher doses at older age. Mm-hmm. And so the dosage requirements, and again, it's not something that we focused on, so not necessarily going to be the most accurate comment, but in terms of what dose is accurate is required and what is safe in terms of being metabolized is also occurring at an older age.
Another confound that I was thinking about as you spoke, and that is, what were the indications? Because you could kind of see a role for this, not waiting till there's absolute need that, you know, the kid's falling down every two steps. But, you know, and you might want to sort of think about doing this a bit preventatively and maybe on a more intermittent schedule rather than a very intense schedule to kind of maintain. How did they talk about what the indications were and how they decided, and was that constant across your studies?
They didn't talk about the indications for it in the studies per se. A lot of times they just said these are the kids that would have casting or kids that have had casting done, and these are the results we found. That Cincinnati Children's Hospital paper that we found with just general guidelines for casting basically just said anyone with a reduced range of motion, such as CP, traumatic brain injuries, they had all these lists of things, but it wasn't, you know, when they get this range of motion, we should cast them. Nothing black and white like that.
And again, that also brings the problem of with serial casting in urban versus rural centers is that a child in an urban center, say as Vancouver, Victoria, with school-age programs, is going to be recognized a lot faster than one in a rural center. So whether they can set straight indications, well, those may not be able to be followed based on the area the child's living.
I think part of what they're also trying to find out was what that duration was, that how long are these range of motion gains going to be maintained, so that we know when is the next opportune time to recast. And so that is reflected in the body of our research in terms of how often people were doing those intervals of follow-up. So, and they were so variable in terms of looking at 6 weeks, 5 months, 6 months. yeah, and so given the variability within that, they still didn't have a specific parameter as to what time frame was ideal for recasting. And so something that I think still needs to be researched.
I do have a couple more. What informed, did you get a sense that as you read through those protocols, did they actually refer to other protocols to guide their recommendations?
We actually found that later in our research. We found that this general guidelines, and it was just basically for any lower extremity casting for all sorts of conditions. And they did actually quote some of the papers that we used, so it was pretty evidence-based. However, they were looking at anyone who would need casting. So it was actually kind of interesting to see later on that this is the general guidelines, CP fits nicely into that, and maybe we can refine them a little bit. And they did use some evidence to back it up, and from what I found on their website, they actually had lots of small little 3, 4, 5 page snippets based on research for different clinical things. So it's actually a pretty good website to check out.
Well, I didn't quite catch as you described the protocol. You had the number of days and then the frequency of repetition. But how long in a given session?
How long would they cast on?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like 1 to 3 weeks was generally used.
Like,
so like they
day
cast
day
for a full,
yeah.
They
yeah.
cast
yeah.
for
yeah.
a full
yeah.
1 week and then
okay.
change the cast.
Okay.
Another week. Yeah.
Whole
so
day.
Like some of the
rest.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
only progressive. Yeah. You have it on for like series.
Oh,
so
we
or something, and then
predominantly week. Five of the 11 studies were a week. One was stated as 1 to 2 weeks, and 3 were stated as 2 weeks that they were changed, and then 2 were changed at 3 weeks. So there's variability within that, but predominantly what everyone needed was changed.
So would they be modified over the test?
So yeah, that's what I was going to say. They're progressive, so they have it on for a week or whatever it is, and then they increase the stretch, and they recast for another So it is a progressive
Removed and reapplied every day for comfort?
No. So it's like your regular cast with a bit of a heel lift or something to increase the amount of movement in the foot. And they actually, when they're doing the casting procedure, I got to witness one, they actually have to hold the foot in that level of casting while the cast and everything is being applied and has to be held there until the cast is set as well.
And then well padded to prevent sores and whatnot occurring. And I think that they've learned a lot from the research was cumulative in terms of how they decided to do the protocol. So like the original study done in 1982 by Tardieu and then 1988 by Tardieu, and they noticed more issues with skin breakdown and that kind of stuff. So they more padding and stuff was developed, and then the changing weekly, that kind of stuff. So they were progressive in some aspect in that, but no conclusiveness in terms of what is the strategy to approach.
One last question. Do you have?
Oh, I was curious about two things. Did anyone really define short-term increase, or is that another kind of? Would you guys say a short-term increase?
Post-casting?
Yeah.
Well, some of the studies remeasured at 2 weeks post. Actually, a lot of them did. Mm-hmm. And in most studies, except for one, I think, whatever improvement was maintained at 2 weeks post-casting. So that was what we were calling short-term. And then it was so variable after that, some of them would remeasure at 5 weeks, some would remeasure at 6 months, 12 months. So those were the longer-term things we were looking at.
And were there any recommendations for serial casting and then continuing on and then recasting after a certain amount of time and did it seem any loss?
That's kind of what we were trying to find.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of variability throughout the studies.
Clinically, I know at Sunny Hill Thursday, like quite often the kids will keep doing it because they don't want to have a kid's first casting, a kid just uses up for 2 years, kids know they're going to need another casting procedure before they're old enough for the surgery. So, at least the one thing we did find is that the improvements in range of motion can be maintained with something like an AFO, which is, if you can do that functionally, it's probably a lot better for the child to be in an AFO to maintain what they have gained, so they're not constantly being captured. But I think it would be a really individual basis based on the child.
And the other question I had was, were the studies consistent? Like, in your results of the session, you looked at qualities. I know. You looked at qualities of gait. And was that just an overarching qualities, or were there any consistency of what particular qualities they would look at with each other?
Well, that's in the section that I was talking about.
Yeah.
So some of them were looking at.
I don't know if you
comment
on them. I just.
Go forward one.
Oh.
So they were looking at equine gait or toe walking. So some of the studies just took like a video of the child walking and then just use general analysis and or observation and just said, okay, so the child is walking on their toes, now post casting, let's watch them again. How does it look? Okay, and then
outcome and then the measures listed there as well.
Yeah, and then some use the physician's rating scale, which I mentioned was they look at crouch. So that if you know what crouch gait is, it's the bend of the hips and the knee. So they give a general rating. Are they in crouch gait or is it moderate crouch gait? So they look at that, the position of the knee, and then foot contact, because these kids are all on their toes,
mm-hmm.
So they want to get them having a flat foot contact. So. Yeah, I mean, generally, all of them did see improvements. It's just how long was it maintained?
You need to see some consistency.
Yeah.
Even toe walking and foot contact. Thanks for going back to that. It was
there's a lot.
That's reflective of it just being a clinical population too, and just the variability in cerebral palsy, right? So it's a challenging group to look at.
Was there any attention to gateway education? Because it seems to me, you learn, you may be a toe walker,
mm-hmm.
and they might have corrected something, but you've learned that pattern of gait.
Yeah.
And I think also this, I would hazard to guess that many of these children were also mentally handicapped, so that was a
right.
Was there any attention given to that? I don't think you discussed immediate generalization to changing your walking.
That's why we wanted to look at it because basically we talk to the supervisor a lot, saying although you may have more range of motion, maybe you're not even really using it functionally, which is why we looked at the gait, the qualities of gait, and ankle kinematics function. I mean, even at Sunny Hill, they were saying that the two don't always match up. Like, they may have more passive range of motion, but they don't use it sometimes.
Yeah,
so,
I think a very simple example of that is a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed new graduate. I remember working in a day hospital setting. I had patients who had Parkinson's, and I decided the cane was way too high for this guy, so I dutifully measured it and got it all right, and he's walking now with the cane 6 inches off the ground. So, I think you cannot expect generalization, and that probably made these results even more favorable.
In several studies, they did have physiotherapy concurrence, so whether those physiotherapy included some education components or not, again, that wasn't stated in the studies.
It was interesting, actually, one study, and it's been a while since I've read that one, but they looked at idiopathic toe walkers versus children with CP, and a lot of them ended up reverting to toe walking as well. So, yeah.
It was a very ingrained pattern.
Yeah.
Any remaining questions? Very good. Thank you very much.